Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, a happy Wednesday morning to you. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Hope you enjoyed your 21-hour break. And let's go. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. 888-914-9149. Cyrus, can you believe it? Somebody sent me a note complaining that I used the phrase tanned, rested, and ready one time. Well, I probably use it more than one.
You're going to have to explain that one to me.
I'm not sure I understand it myself.
Tanned, rested.
We get, as you know, a big volume of email.
Well, I wrote that email, Patrick, because I don't tan, and so I think it's borderline racist that you would suggest that everyone can tan because I don't.
Maybe that was, well, if you wrote it, then that would explain it. But I scratched my head over it. Anyway, I am tanned, rested, and ready, even if you're not. Post-Taco Tuesday, 888-914-9149 is the number to call if you want to be on the air. I've got an interesting little detail here. I find these things endlessly interesting, having to do with health issues. And this one here has to do with how you take pills. So, I mean, if it's a vitamin, if it's an aspirin, if it's any kind of pill, there's some new information out that I will share with you about your posture. In other words, what is your bodily posture when you take a pill, and how does that affect the efficacy, that's the word I'm looking for, of the pill. So here it goes. This is from India Today, I believe it is. Researchers examining the mechanics of drug dissolution in the natural anatomy of the stomach found that taking a pill while lying on your right side shortens the time it takes for the medicine to be absorbed. Pay close attention, Cyrus. You never know when this information could come in handy. When you have a headache and reach for the pain reliever, you're probably not thinking about your body position when you take the pill. But a new Johns Hopkins University study finds your posture can make a big difference in how fast your body absorbs the medicine, and the wrong posture can delay how fast the medicine is broken down and absorbed by as much as an hour. The findings are based on what's thought to be the first model to simulate the mechanics of drug dissolution on a human stomach. One of the senior authors of the study at Johns Hopkins, he's an engineer, Rajat Mittal, he says, "We were very surprised that posture had such an immense effect on the dissolution rate of a pill. I never thought about whether I was doing it right or wrong, but I will now definitely think about it every time I take a pill." And this, by the way, is published in the peer-reviewed journal Physics of Fluids. I don't think it's about wine, though. In recent years, models have been created to authentically represent workings of several major organs, notably the heart. The model developed by the team called Stomach Sim. You have that game on your phone, don't you, Cyrus? Stomach Sim? I thought I saw you playing Stomach Sim recently.
I was playing it right now. I don't even know what you're talking about because I was busy playing it.
Get off the Stomach Sim. It appears to be one of the first to be able to conduct realistic simulation of the human stomach, blending physics with biomechanics and fluid mechanics. Stomach Sim sounds like a really terrible game. Mimics what is happening inside. It sounds pretty terrible. It mimics what is happening inside the stomach as it digests food, or in this case, medicine. Most pills do not start working until the stomach ejects their contents into the intestine. So the closer a pill lands to the lower part of your stomach, the antrum, the faster it starts to dissolve and empty its contents through the pylorus into the duodenum. Well, this is taking me back to my anatomy and physiology class.
Man, I haven't even had a full cup of coffee yet.
I'm talking about the pylorus and the duodenum and the antrum. It's kind of like politics and making. How do they say that? Politics and making sausage. You don't want to see how it's done.
Yeah, you don't want to see how it's made.
And you don't want to see the pill dissolving in your duodenum. I bet you didn't even know you had a duodenum, did you?
All right. Blushing.
If you're aiming for a pill for this part of the stomach, posture is critical to both gravity and the natural asymmetry of the stomach. The team tested four postures. Here we go. Taking pills while lying on your right side. And they say that's by far the best way. Take them lying down on your side, right side. That sends the pill into the deepest part of your stomach to achieve a dissolution rate that is 2.3 times faster than even an upright posture. Lying on your left side is the worst. The team was very surprised to find that if a pill takes 10 minutes to dissolve on the right side, it could take 23 minutes to dissolve in an upright posture. And check this out. And over 100 minutes if you take the pill while lying on your left side. Who would have thunk it? For elderly, sedentary, or bedridden people, whether they're turning to left or to the right can have a huge impact. Standing upright was a decent second choice, essentially tied in effectiveness with lying straight on your back. I never really take pills lying straight on my back.
No, I don't take them or lying down.
Or on my right side or my left side.
Right. I tend to spill water all over
the place.
That
sounds like a
Dr.
Seuss book. I don't take pills on my back. I don't take them lying down. I don't take them on my side. I can't find a rhyme for that.
Nope.
So, I mean, I could go on, but I think you get the idea. You get the idea, right? So I think this is interesting. So if the next time if you have a headache, a toothache, stomach ache, what have you, if you see, Cyrus, if you see me lying down on my right side, popping pills, it's probably just vitamins. No worries. 888. I wonder, does this mean that coffee will have a faster effect? You'll wake up faster if you Ooh. Drink coffee lying on your right side?
All right. All right. Now I'm interested.
Now, because now you have a purpose for this.
Right. This is practical to my life now.
Why don't we do, how about this, Cyrus, as part of tomorrow's show prep, why don't you try that?
My and wife's going to be like, why is there coffee stains all over the couch? I was like, Patrick Madrid told
you
me to
lounging?
Drink coffee laying down.
On my right side. So that would mean you're either, well, I guess you could at either end of the couch. But yes, so Cyrus, please kindly post this for everybody who's interested. I think almost everybody at some point takes a pill. So this can be helpful. And of course, it's science. And science is good. And we're supposed to listen to the science, right? So there's some science for you. 888. 914-9149. Let's go to Phoenix and talk to Julie. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
Can you hear me? Hi.
Yes. Have you had your pills this morning?
Oh.
Your vitamins?
No, I haven't. No, not yet.
Okay.
So my question was, I wanted to know the difference in the merit, if there is, when we go to a parish and we ask them to offer a mass for a certain reason or a person. Mm-hmm. And then what is the difference when we go to mass by ourselves and we personally before mass, we offer our own intentions, does that, can you understand my question?
Yeah, I understand. So in other words, okay. What is the relative benefit? Maybe we could put it that way between the mass being offered for in your intention versus you making the intention in your heart at mass. Is that another way to say it?
Yeah. Does it have a greater effect for the intention if you go through the parish or you know?
It does. I can explain that to you. So the difference here is obviously when you receive Holy Communion, for example, and you offer your intention. In other words, you're offering to the Lord the spiritual benefit from this reception of the Holy Eucharist and by being at Mass, let's say for a deceased loved one, for example. Well, that has great merit. It is powerful and meritorious and efficacious. But I would say that the difference here in favor of the Mass being celebrated for the intention of that person is more powerful because the priest who's celebrating the Mass, that is the intention he brings with himself to the altar. And so as he offers this sacrifice, the once for all sacrifice of Christ on the cross can never be repeated, but we are made present at that once for all sacrifice at each Mass. That has tremendous power because it is the priest who is making that that in mass intention at the mass. So the mass itself is being offered for that person. And that's a greater degree, you might say, of efficacy or spiritual benefit to the person than the benefit that he would receive if you make the mass intention in your heart. That's good. The mass being offered for that person is better, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, the way you explained it, it's kind of self-explanatory, but I didn't explain it in my
head. That's okay. And you know what else? You can make your mass intention for all of your past sins. So this is something that I do on a regular basis as part of the prayer, the mass prayers, the intentions that I bring with me to mass. You know, Lord, for all the sins of my past life, for all the sins that I've committed and all the sins I've caused others to commit, I offer this reception of Holy Communion in reparation for that. So that's a regular intention of mine, among others, but yeah, so I don't want to forget the fact that in the midst of praying for other people, I've got to pray for myself too, prayers of repentance and prayers of praise and so on. So personally, I find that very helpful.
Okay, that was beautiful. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Julie. Great talking to you. How about Yvonne now in Hampstead, North Carolina? Good morning, Yvonne. Welcome.
Yes, hi, good morning. Thank you. So I know you talked about this topic quite a bit recently, but can you please clarify why there will not be a pre-tribulation rapture? My sister she's Catholic and she's practicing, she listed some verses that confuse her. So she said, and I had her listen to you yesterday. I had her listen to yesterday's show, and she said, I still don't understand why that teaching is faulty. So, okay, the first one she listed is Revelation 3:10, Daniel 12:1-2, and Luke 17:34-37.
How about this? Mm-hmm. How about this? I'll never be able to retain all those verses in my mind going forward. So why don't I do this? I can take up those verses for you, but let me give a kind of a big picture explanation. That might be the easiest way to ease into this topic. So let's start, first of all, by saying the Catholic Church teaches that there will be a rapture because the Bible teaches that there will be a rapture, and that's found in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. And I'll read that to you in just a minute. So it's not as though the church says, no, there's no rapture. It's just, when will the rapture take place? And so in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we read, "For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, shall be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we shall always be with the Lord." Now, a few little details to make note of. First of all, that phrase that he uses, well, that we translate in English, to be caught up together with them in the air, in the clouds, that word in Latin is rapiemur, and it is a root word for words like rapture, rape, etc. And it means literally to be snatched away, to be snatched up or caught up. In the case of rape, you know, the man is grabbing the woman and taking her someplace against her will. So the rapture, the word rapture in English comes from that word, and that's how St. Jerome translated it from the Greek into Latin for the Latin Vulgate. And that's where this word, the rapture, kind of came into popular parlance in English. But you'll notice there that this is describing the end of the world. This is describing when the Lord comes back to judge the nations, as he himself talks about in Matthew chapter 25. And it's not as the pre-tribulation rapture people think. It's not a secret rapture. This is part of the pre-tribulation rapture error, is they say that there will be another return of Christ, but the only people who are going to know about that are the people who are raptured, the true Christians, quote unquote, and everyone else will be left behind. And so this is one of the passages that is used as a proof text for the pre-tribulation rapture, but it completely unravels because this is describing not a secret, quiet, hidden return of Jesus, but it's something that's very public with a cry of command, with the archangel's call, with the sound of the trumpet of God, so loud that it's going to wake the dead, literally. So this is clearly not a pre-tribulation event. That's one of them. So also, we notice that in Matthew chapter 24, verses 37 through 42, this is another common proof text, as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they did not know until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one is taken, one is left. This is where the left behind motif comes from. One is taken, one is left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one is taken and one is left. Watch therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. Well, first of all, in context, here Jesus is referring to the destruction of Jerusalem. That took place in the year 70. And we know this because earlier in the same passage, Matthew chapter 24, he says this generation to, you know, he's saying about the people who are there seeing and seeing him speak, this generation will not pass away until these things take place. That's in verse 34. He also says that this is something that's going to be just like the days of Noah. But when you look at what happened with Noah, the people who were taken away, those are the people who are the unrighteous. The righteous were left behind. I mean, there were only eight of them, and they were on the ark, and they survived the great flood. They were left behind. The people who were taken away or swept away, those were the people who were wicked. Well, and even innocent people as well, for that matter. So it's the exact opposite of the rapture. So if this passage is teaching the rapture, which it's not, there's another big problem here because Jesus identifies it. He says it will be just like the days of Noah. Well, pre-tribulation rapture theory is not just like the days of Noah. And remember, too, that in the same passage, in Matthew 24, verse 13, Jesus says, he who endures to the end will be saved. He doesn't talk about people who don't endure to the end. These are, in the pre-tribulation rapture theory, these are the people who, according to the theory, they get taken out, taken up, taken away. 1 Corinthians 15, 51 through 52. Lo, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Now notice here, this is one of those proof texts, but what does it say? At the last trumpet, for the trumpet will sound and the dead will be raised imperishable and we will be changed. So this is referring to the rapture, but it's saying it specifically, this is not pre-tribulation, this is at the end of time. This is when the Lord returns. And that changing in the twinkling of an eye means moving from mortality to immortality. And I think this is the verse that you mentioned a moment ago, Revelation chapter 3, verse 10. Because you, referring to the church at Philadelphia, have kept my word of patient endurance, I will keep you from the hour of trial that is coming on the whole world to test the inhabitants of the earth. So does that support the pre-tribulation rapture? No, it really doesn't. You see that this is referring to the second coming of Christ. It's not a secret rapture. It's not something that happens before the second coming of Christ. But the phrase, keep you from the hour of testing, means that the church is not going to be removed from the tribulation. It means that the church is going to endure and suffer persecution and come out triumphant through the persecution of the Antichrist. And we can point to John chapter 17, verse 15, where Jesus says, I do not pray that thou, speaking to the Father here, I do not pray that thou shouldst take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil one. And in John 16, 33, the Lord says, in the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. And in John 15, verse 19, he says that you have been chosen out of the world, but he does not say that you will be taken out of the world prior to a time of persecution. Another verse that's commonly brought up, and I'll have to leave it at this only because we have to take a break, but one more verse for you, Yvonne, Revelation 4, verses 1 through 2. After this, I looked, and lo, in heaven, an open door. And the first voice, which I had heard speaking to me like a trumpet, said, come up hither, and I will show you what must take place after this. At once I was in the Spirit, and lo, a throne stood in heaven, with one seated on the throne. Now, many people who believe in the pre-tribulation rapture, they'll quote this passage and they'll say that John symbolizes the church. Although, oddly enough, they very often deny that John symbolizes the church in John chapter 19 at the foot of the cross where the Lord gives him the care of his mother. Son, behold your mother. Woman, behold your son. But that's beside the point. Very often they'll say this refers to the church in the person of John being told, come up here. Well, there's a big problem. Because in the book of Revelation, you keep reading, and St. John comes back to earth after he is told to come up to heaven. He sees what he sees up there, and then he is sent back to earth. That, too, is completely out of sync with the notion of a pre-tribulation rapture. So I'll have to leave it at that, Yvonne. I apologize for not being able to give you more information, but that at least touched upon the verses, or at least a couple of the ones that you mentioned. For further reading, if you're interested, I wrote a book called Does the Bible Really Say That? Discovering Catholic Teaching in Scripture. I have a whole chapter just on that topic. If you're interested, thank you. I'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. My number is 888-914-9149. Notre Dame. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code PATRICK for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Wow.
I drank a little bit of coffee on my... I drank some coffee on my laying on my right side, and I'm just ready to go, Patrick. Let's go.
I can tell. Wow. Yeah, this takes me back to my GarageBand days. Well, let's see. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Let's go over to, where are we going? Let's go to Matt in Fresno. Good morning, Matt.
Hey, good morning, Pat.
Hello, Matt.
My question is, can I get a tattoo covered up with another tattoo? Because it's going to be a while before I get this thing lasered off.
Well, I mean, there's a difference, obviously, between can and should. Can you? Sure, you can. Should you? It's up to you, really. Is the first tattoo something that's offensive, or do you regret putting it on there and you wish you didn't have to look at it, or what?
Yeah, I regret all my tattoos. I mean, ever since I've became a Catholic. Well, one of them's vulgar. There's no nudity. It's just vulgar. And I don't like little kids to see it.
Smart. That's very smart. Isn't it amazing how what seems cool and desirable at one point in your life, you look back on it later and shake your head and say, what was I thinking?
Yeah.
Well, so if you were... Well, here's my question, because I don't have any tattoos. I certainly don't plan to get any. But my question is, if you can spend the time in the tattoo chair to get another tattoo to cover that up, isn't it more or less about the same amount of time commitment to get it lasered off? And wouldn't it be more difficult to laser it off if you now have two tattoos, one over the other? I mean, I don't know, but I'm assuming that's probably going to be more of an ordeal if you have a second tattoo. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. It just bothers me.
I heard once that somebody had a tattoo of Drew Mariani, and they wanted to cover it up with a tattoo of Cyrus Simcoe, but I don't know how that went.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so it's up to you, Matt. It's your personal choice. When I've talked about tattoos before, I try to take into account the fact that this is a very, very popular thing nowadays. And even though I personally don't favor tattoos and I don't advise them, in part for the reason that you just said, because what seems really cool now You may not think it's very cool 10, 15, 20 years from now, but in any case, the church doesn't say you can't get a tattoo. The church does warn about the danger of vanity, which is a form of pride. That's certainly, that could be a sinful reason to get a tattoo if you just want people to ogle you. And I've noticed that especially, well, I mean, it's, I think it's men and women, people who tend to get tattoos tend to get them in places where people can see them. They want to be seen. And for that reason, it's always good to check your motives and say, am I doing this for a sinful reason like vanity, or is there some other reason that might be good? But as far as you're concerned, Matt, I mean, obviously you don't need my permission. You can do either way. But if I had to guess, I would think you'd be complicating matters if you added a second tattoo. Why not just go in and get the first one lasered off if that's possible?
Yep, that's what I'm going to do. It is more like a vanity thing growing up. Now it's just horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, well, fair enough. And I admire your pluck. You know, you see something that's not right and you don't want to live with it that way, and you're going to take steps to take care of it. I think that's a good thing. It says a lot of good about you, Matt.
Well, thank you, Patrick. Half Siders exercise those speakers. Rock on.
Okay, I will. You hear that, Cyrus? You have an ethical permission slip from Matt to crank the music.
Matt gets it.
But I think that one person who wrote me a note and said, stop playing the music so loud, he'll probably have to turn it down. Thanks, Matt. Let's go to Steve in Elsa, Texas. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Hello, Steve. Yes.
Oh, my yes, question, I kind of have a... interesting question. So basically, I've been in RCIA, and recently I've been talking about the four apostles, the four evangelists. And my question
evangelists.
Is like, the evangelists, yeah. The angel, the ox, the lion, and the eagle, right? What is their history? Like, how did they somehow have a correlation?
So you're talking about the symbols that symbolize the four writers of the Gospels, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take a look at that. So we see that there are each of the Gospels has a symbol associated with it. And they are, St. Matthew is a man, St. Mark is a winged lion, and St. Luke is a winged ox. You don't see too many of those. And St. John is a rising eagle. So this is the animal or the human personage that stands for that. So here's how it is explained from the Bible. In Ezekiel chapter 1, verses 1 through 21, it says, in the 30th year, on the fifth day of the fourth month, while I was among the exiles by the river Chebar, the heavens opened and I saw divine visions. As I looked, a storm wind came from the north, a huge cloud with flashing fire, from the midst of which something gleamed like electrum. Within it were figures resembling four living creatures that looked like this. Their form was human, but each had four faces and four wings, and their legs went straight down. The soles of their feet were round. They sparkled with a gleam like burnished bronze. Their faces were like this. Each of the four had the face of a man, but on the right side was the face of a lion, and on the left the face of an ox, and finally each had the face of an eagle. Now this is echoed in the book of Revelation. So now we're going to look at Revelation chapter 4. And here's what it says beginning in verse 6. Surrounding this throne were 24 other thrones upon which were seated 24 elders. They were clothed in white garments and had crowns of gold on their heads. From the throne came flashes of lightning and peals of thunder. Before it burned seven flaming torches, the seven spirits of God. The floor around the throne was like a sea of glass, that it was crystal clear. At the very center, around the throne itself, stood four living creatures covered with eyes front and back. The first creature resembled a lion, the second an ox, the third had the face of a man, while the fourth looked like an eagle in flight. Each of the four living creatures had six wings and eyes all over, inside and out. Day and night, without pause, they sing, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, he who was and who is to come." So, in the early church, beginning with figures like St. Irenaeus, for example, these symbols, and they're, especially the one in the book of Revelation, is referring to angels. But these symbols became associated with the different gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so, for example, St. Irenaeus, he talks about this in his work called Against Heresies. And he says, in that work, he says, the first living creature was like a lion, symbolizing his effectual working, his leadership and royal power. The second was like a calf, signifying his sacrificial and sacerdotal order. Sacerdotal means priestly. But the third had, as it were, the face as of a man, an evident description of his advent as a human being. The fourth was like a flying eagle, pointing out the gift of the Spirit hovering with his wings over the church. And therefore, the Gospels are in accord with these things among which Christ Jesus is seated. So in this vein, the different animals, and in the case of the man, are associated with the different gospel writers. St. Irenaeus says, St. Matthew is represented by a divine man because the gospel highlights Jesus' entry into this world first by presenting his family lineage, a family record of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. That's in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, and his incarnation and birth. And St. Irenaeus says, by quoting St. Matthew, this is how the birth of Jesus Christ came about. This then, according to St. Irenaeus, is the gospel of his humanity, because it emphasizes that. The gospel of St. Mark is represented by a winged lion, and St. Irenaeus talks about how this references the prophet Isaiah when he begins his gospel. Here begins the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. In Isaiah, when he writes, he says, I send my messenger before you to prepare your way, a herald's voice in the desert. Make ready the way of the Lord, clear him a straight path. The voice in the desert crying reminds one of a lion's roar, and the prophetic spirit descending to earth reminds one of a winged message. The lion also signifies royalty, which is appropriate for the Son of God. The winged ox represents St. Luke. Oxen were used for sacrifices in the temple. So when the Ark of the Covenant was brought back to Jerusalem after having been captured in battle by the Philistines, and then it's brought back to the city of David, what does he do? He has an ox sacrificed every six steps. This is in 2 Samuel chapter 6. St. Luke begins his gospel with the announcement of the birth of St. John the Baptist to his father, the priest Zechariah, who offered what? He offered a sacrifice in the temple, Luke chapter 1. St. Luke also includes the parable of the prodigal son, in which, what happens? The fatted calf is slaughtered, not only to celebrate the younger son's return, but to foreshadow the joy that we will see in reconciling ourselves with God, our high priest, with Jesus, our high priest. And lastly, St. John is represented by a flying eagle, because his gospel begins with a lofty prologue. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So he starts before time itself. And so that gospel, which is unique in that regard, concentrates on the divinity of Jesus. And so, as St. Irenaeus and others say, that this rising eagle is an apt symbol to symbolize the loftiness of his gospel. Now, I'm sharing with you not only from things taken from the Catholic Encyclopedia online, also what the Bible says in Ezekiel, for example, but also what St. Irenaeus says. And what I will do is ask Cyrus to post a resource for you if you're interested in reading more about this, including some of the things that I just read to you verbatim. He'll get this article posted for you so that you can read it for yourself and go a little bit deeper. How does that sound, Steve?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. Glad I could be of service. Let's go to Bridget now in Arlington, Texas. And we have a lot of Texas representation this morning. That's great. Welcome, Bridget.
Hi, Patrick. I'm, you know, originally a Yankee, but I came down at 28. And I'm 63 now. I'm, you know, also a widow 9 years. This is the thing, okay? I just curiously... My son, you know, when I were talking this morning, he works the night shift, and he's 37, you know, I got a daughter, 40, and a granddaughter. But enough about me. He said something about this one priest that's famous, and he goes, you know, he's kind of like, and he used the technical name, you know, like old-fashioned Catholic, so he took the era of what he thought was this guy. And he liked him before. And I'm thinking, why are you, I didn't say anything, but why are you criticizing him, you know? So I wanted to ask you, you know, you've got the evangelicals that are, you know, kind of like the left of the church, and you have the old-fashioned, and then you have whatever's modern day, you know. And modern day to me seems like, well, I've had my faith since a little girl, and I went to Catholic school and everything, but it's grown over the years, you know, and it's especially grown last year with me. And I
let me ask you a question, Bridget. I'm not entirely sure what your question is, so maybe I just need some. Maybe I need to lie on my right side and drink some coffee so it gets to my brain faster. But in lieu of that, could you just state your question in one sentence so that I can make sure I know what you're driving at?
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. What? Where are you? Where are you as far as being a Catholic? You know what I mean? Like, where are you? Like in the timeline? Are you?
Do you mean like when was I born, or
no?
Or how do I look at the church? Like, or
yeah, how you look at the church? You know, do you look at it as, you know? Well, it's the people, you know, the word, but I mean, how do you...
Let me take a shot at it. I'll try to take a shot. I consider myself a Catholic who is, I seek to be a loyal son of the church, and I recognize that the church, as St. Augustine said, is ever ancient, ever new. And so I am moving with the church into the future and all that that may bring, but I look back on the church's past, and I treasure the patrimony of the last 2,000 years that has been handed down to me. And being a Latin Rite Catholic, of course, that's the rite that I'm most familiar with. And so that would include, for example, I treasure the patrimony of the traditional Latin Mass. I am quite comfortable and content to go to the new rite of the Mass. This is where my wife and I, well, the parish that we belong to, they don't have the traditional Latin Mass, but they have a very beautiful, reverent, and I would argue very traditional celebration of the new rite of the Mass, and I'm quite comfortable in that as well. So I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I don't look at, oh, that's pre-Vatican II. I don't want that. No, I think that's foolish for people who do that. I embrace all of it, and that's really what the word Catholic is all about. It means that you have a universality about you in accepting what is a unity, but it involves pluriformity. So there is this pluriformity variety, if we want to use that term, that subsists in the unity of the church, meaning that there are many different expressions that are valid and unique, and yet it's all part of the same one thing, the same church, the same gospel that Jesus preached and that the church preserves down through the ages. Now, I hope that that is getting at what you're looking at. I consider myself to be a traditionalist in the fullest sense of the word. I think all Catholics should be that, and that is that we embrace all of the church and we don't reject any part of it. We don't reject the traditional Latin Mass. We don't reject the things that have come before. I think that, as I said, is foolish to do that. But at the same time, we embrace the church as it is now and we move forward with the church into the future. So if I'm understanding
right,
your question, that would be my answer.
That, and the reason I'm prompted that question is because, you know, you got to get into the minds of the young people. You know what I mean? Okay, yes, my kids are good. Yes, they're Catholic still. They go to church, but they have questions in their mind, you know? And I felt like you shouldn't, what you told us on the air is that, yeah, you're a traditionalist. You're moving along. You know, our Pope...
Well, I wish I had more time, Bridget. Forgive me. The music says I got to stop. I think I understand what you're saying. Thank you. Great talking to you. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Let's get back to it. 888-914-9149. You can call me right now. I've got a line or two open. Just waiting for your call, 888-914-9149. Also, please don't forget, we are pretty much at the end of the line, close, for you to get a free copy of my brand new book called Inquisition. It came out within the last 2 weeks. Yesterday, I think I said 10 days ago, but I think it's more like 2 weeks ago. And it was a huge print run, and within the space of that first 2 weeks, more than half of the books were claimed by people who wanted their free copy. And by free, I mean free. You don't pay shipping or handling. You don't pay for the book. You don't pay for anything. You just say, here's my name. Here's where I want you to send my book. And we will. And people are starting to get them now. But they are moving at such a fast pace that if you wait, I think if you wait until like next week, you probably won't be able to get them because they'll be exhausted. So if you haven't done so already, go to relevantradio.com/quiz and order your free book. And it will come to you in the mail. And I think you're going to like it. In fact, I really hope you like it because everyone I've seen who's taken a look at it, they tell me that they laughed out loud a few times. They had some nice laughs because some of the stuff is a little bit on the humorous side. But everybody who's read it tells me that they've learned something. And often people came to the book thinking, well, I already probably know all these answers. And they were surprised that some of the things that they thought they knew, they were actually a little bit off. And some things that they never knew. Oh, wow, I never knew that. And so on and so forth. So this is free to you, but you have to act quickly. If you have a loved one in the military, a son or daughter overseas, a husband overseas, a wife overseas, whatever your situation is, you can let these people know about getting their free book wherever they may be in the military by using the U.S. Postal Service's APO-FPO address system. So distance for them is not a barrier. If you're in Canada, you can order this book for free. Same as in the United States. Works both ways. So just go to relevantradio.com/quiz. You'll see the book. You'll see a little bit about the book. And really, all you have to do is just say, here's my name. Here's where I want you to send the book. And that's it. But please act quickly before they're all gone. So let's go to Mark in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Yesterday, I spotted one of your books. I've always wanted to get one of your books. I never knew which one to get, but I spotted one in the bookstore yesterday, Surprised by Truth. And I looked at the chapters, and after each chapter, I saw a name. I was unclear what that name was. Did you write the whole book, or did these names have anything to do with the writing? Or
sure, I'll explain the format of the book. So I was the editor of these 11 stories. There were originally going to be 12, and a woman who had agreed to write her chapter, I don't remember now, it's almost 30 years ago that the book came out, but for whatever reason, she was going to be the 12th story, and maybe she got busy or something happened. So I wound up with 11 stories. And so each person, and these are the names that you're referring to, including people like Paul Thigpen and Tim Staples and Marcus Grodi, and who am I forgetting? There's 11 of them. So each of these people wrote their own stories. Now, I was the editor, so I did not write these stories. In a few cases, there were some who, you know, not being writers themselves, they didn't really know how to write it in a way that would be publishable, so I helped them. And so part of my editing duties in a few of these chapters, not all of them, was to help them write the chapter so that it would sound understandable. So when you read each of the chapters in the book, Surprised by Truth, you will be reading their stories told in their own words. And I was just simply in the capacity as an editor to make sure that this, you know, was intelligible.
I see.
So that's it. That's the structure of the book.
Yeah, well, I okay, well, I wanted to get a book that you wrote. Which one would you recommend? I'm gonna search for that. That was the only one I spotted there.
But, okay.
Out of the books that you wrote, which one would you recommend that I get?
I first of all would recommend that you get the free book that I have for you. It's just out the last 2 weeks. It's called Inquisition, Q&A for the Curious Catholic and the Catholic Curious. It's a book of quizzes. And each of the quizzes has about a dozen, 14, 15 questions. And each of the questions has 5 multiple choice answers. So it's a fun book. You'll learn a lot. And if you want to start with that, that's free. You don't pay for shipping or handling. Just go to relevantradio.com/quiz and you can order it when we hang up. I would encourage you to do that. Now, if you want any of the other books,
I've already got that ordered, and I'm waiting.
Oh, wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. And I hope you enjoy it when you get it. So if you go to the show page, go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. And underneath where it says The Patrick Madrid Show, you'll see where it says links. If you click the links and then go to my website, you will have, you'll be able to see all the books. And just recently, Holy Heroes has started to handle book fulfillment for me. So I pay them to fulfill books because I'm not able to juggle all those plates myself. So if you want to make it even easier, you could go to holyheroes.com and then click on the link for Patrick Madrid books. You'll see them all there as well. Now, if you're asking for a recommendation, I mean, I'm like a proud father. I love all of them. They're like my children. But the book that I published with Doubleday is one that I'm particularly happy about. It's called Why Be Catholic? 10 Answers to a Very Important Question. That's a hardcover, and I think you might find that very helpful. I think it's a good book. Of course, I'm biased. And then if you want something that's a little more personal, well, actually a lot more personal, I wrote a book of 50 stories. It's called Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years. And I'm going to have to update that book now. But 50 short chapters, each one of which is an anecdote about something. Many of them are just something ridiculous that happened to me or something stupid I did or some lesson I learned the hard way. And I share these anecdotes from my own life. And each of them is kind of wrapped around a lesson that I learned that I share. So it's all autobiographical, but you might find some value in that as well. So that one's called Life Lessons. Thanks, Mark. I appreciate the call, and I hope you enjoy the books that you pick out. Let's go now to Joe in Los Angeles. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you? I'm sorry. Well, you are one of the best Catholic supporters that I have seen or heard, rather.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate you.
Thank you.
I've been a Democrat, and let me give you an example. Okay. In California, our governor just signed a law to where we're going to be paying for people to come to California and have abortions, including minors. Now, all Democrats are in the wrong path. They're becoming socialists. And I'm getting nervous, but bottom line is, as a Democrat, do I have a responsibility electing Democrats? I think I know the answer, but I want your opinion.
Hmm. The best way I can answer your question, Joe, is you should be, and this is what I seek to do myself, you should be above party politics. And first and foremost, you're a follower of Jesus. You're a Catholic. And that's your party affiliation, if ever there were one. And so the way I approach things personally is politics is a necessary part of human life. We're political creatures. We just live that way. And that's an important dimension of our human interaction. We need politics, and we need good politics and good politicians so that we can have order and people can flourish and be happy. That's the purpose of politics. Now, in the minds of many politicians, that's not the purpose of politics. For them, the purpose of politics is to amass power and wield it and maintain it at all costs. But that's not the paradigm, in my view, of what politics is all about. So my advice would be first and foremost a Catholic, be a follower of Jesus, and vote that way. So if you're being asked to vote on whether it's a referendum for proposed law, or a candidate who is running on a certain platform proposing certain laws, if you can vote with a clear conscience for a candidate to help poor people, do that. If you can vote with a clear conscience to help vote for a candidate who wants to help immigrants, do that. If you can vote with a clear conscience for a candidate who wants to save unborn babies from the evil of abortion, do that. So from a positive standpoint, my advice would be take your Catholic faith with you. Never leave it at home. Don't leave home without it, as the saying goes. Especially when you go into the voting booth, vote as a Catholic, not as a Democrat or a Libertarian or a Republican or any of those things. Those are just party affiliations, and you and I, all of us, we should transcend our party affiliations, because these parties are by no means perfect, and in some ways they're pretty disastrously bad, even evil. So that's my advice. Don't be a Democrat, don't be a Republican first, be a Catholic first, follower of Jesus first, and then vote according to the principles. Now, it may also be that you may say, well, I really like how this candidate says he or she is going to help poor people. I like that, and I want to support that. But the same candidate says, rah-rah, sis, boom-bah, let's have abortion. Well, I can't vote for that candidate, even though I might like to, because of his issue on one, I'm sorry, his approach on one issue, like poverty, for example. But it gets canceled out because that candidate is also supporting abortion. So in a way, for me, if we can use a parallel, it would be like as if you wanted to support the candidate who's really good about helping poor people. That's great. That's a good thing. But what if he believes in slavery? What if he says, you know, if I get into office, I'm going to make sure that slavery is protected and that slave owners have rights and they have the right to own other people as slaves? Well, I mean, that would completely cancel out, for me, my desire to vote for that candidate because he's good on poverty. You see what I'm saying? And it goes in both directions. There's plenty of fault to go around in these political parties in different ways and to different degrees. But if you vote your conscience as a Catholic first and keep in mind the hierarchy of goods, and not killing people is a really high good compared to something else. So that's my advice, Joe. I'll be right back.